Well, good evening. It's a pleasure to be with you again for another lesson. And we'll get the microphone turned on here. I really appreciate the group here. I really appreciate the invitation by the elders to come and be with you this weekend. I really appreciate the participation of the group. I'm grateful for the song leaders who've been so thoughtful in their song selection. You've done an excellent job contributing to our worship together. So thank you for that. And that is actually our topic for tonight. We're going to be talking about true worship, looking at John chapter 4, that really well-known chapter in the Gospel of John, where Jesus interacts with the Samaritan woman. And what I'd like for us to do is I'd like for us to go ahead and turn over there and start reading a couple of verses from the text. We'll start in John chapter 4 and verse 1. Now, when Jesus learned that the Pharisees had heard that Jesus was making and baptizing more disciples than John, although Jesus himself did not baptize, but only his disciples, he left Judea and departed again for Galilee. And he had to pass through Samaria. So he came to a town of Samaria called Sychar, near the field that Jacob had given to his son Joseph. Jacob's well was there. So, Jesus, wearied as he was from his journey, was sitting beside the well. It was about the sixth hour. If you're looking at the map up on the screen, looking down below Samaria, you see Ephraim. And following the green arrows, you work through the area of Samaria. And there are competing ideas about what route Jesus may have taken here in John chapter 4. I remember as a kid hearing teachers and preachers make the point that Jews would not have traveled through Samaria. The more that we come to understand history, that's actually not the most accurate statement to make. Because the most direct route was through the area. They most likely did travel through the area, but they would have limited their interaction with Samaritans. So they would have avoided as much as possible interacting with them on certain levels, but they would have gone through the region. They would not have jumped across the river, hiked up, and then jumped back across the river. The Jews were more practical and pragmatic than that. So we understand there was some hostility and some derision that they had towards Samaritans. Jesus is going through this area. And it gets to the time where they'd be hungry and thirsty, and they stop. And Jesus waits by the well while the disciples go to find something to eat and to drink. And while he's sitting by that well, he has this famous interaction with a Samaritan woman. Now, we're going to talk more about the rest of the chapter here in just a second. But during our trips to Israel, the team had the opportunity to stop and go to the traditional location of Jacob's well. So what I'd like to share with you next is just a couple of minutes from that footage, and then we'll continue reading and have the rest of our lesson.
And I wanted to bring you here and show you this because there is very, very good historical evidence to show that this is the actual hole in the ground that was dug by Jacob and his men over 3,500 years ago.
We're not able to say that very often.
No, we're not. But the historical evidence here is very, very strong.
The fact that you had a well of that nature, that depth, through that type of ground, it makes sense that they'd be able to keep track of that over such a long period of time.
So if that was the well Jacob dug, this is the same location where Jesus had this conversation with the Samaritan woman. Let me read a couple of verses here from John, the fourth chapter. So he came to a town of Samaria called Sychar, near the field that Jacob had given to his son Joseph. Jacob's well was there. So Jesus, wearied as he was from his journey, was sitting beside the well, and it was about the sixth hour.
To have Jesus in Samaria in the first place and to initiate this conversation with a Samaritan woman is pretty significant. The woman went into logistics. How on earth are you going to get any water? The well is really deep.
I tell you what, why don't you draw some water for us? Very good. Okay, okay, Jeremy, there's one other thing I want you to do for me. I want you to dip a cup of this water and pour it down the well. And I want you to be real quiet. I want you to listen so you can see how deep it is.
How high up is that?
It's amazing, isn't it? It's got to be well over 100 feet deep.
Wow.
Yeah.
There are nuances to the story about the depth of the well that we would just gloss over. Well, of course the well is deep. So going to that place and playing with the water really highlighted a seemingly insignificant line in this interaction between Jesus and the Samaritan woman. And there are things like that all through the Bible. And they emphasize these were real people in real places, and even those small details are important and connect us to reality.
Jesus stops and interacts with a Samaritan, but not just any Samaritan. He interacts with a woman, which is culturally not normal, and he interacts with a woman of disreputable character. I mean, she's had multiple husbands. He's never met her before, but he understands what her character has been. And he has this long verbal exchange with her, and at the conclusion of it, he's able to talk to her about who the Messiah is and how to worship God.
What Jesus was trying to get to as he interacted with this woman was to make the connection that he was providing living water to her. And they go back and forth with this dialogue. The topic changes quickly over the course of a very short conversation, but Jesus is moving it to a very important point.
There are a couple of passages at the end of that exchange where the woman said to him, "I know that Messiah is coming, he who is called Christ. When he comes, he will tell us all things." And Jesus said to her, "I who speak to you am he." And so Jesus reveals to this Samaritan woman that he's the long-awaited Messiah. And she runs into town and tells everybody what she's experienced. They all come out, and he spends a couple of days there and helps this entire town come to realize who he is.
So many biblical events happened right here.
There are just so many layers of history to this one spot.
So I anticipate during the question and answer that someone's going to ask, what did the water taste like? So I'm just going to answer that right now. I don't know. I was so busy playing with the water, I never stopped to drink from the water. And there was only the one tin cup, and so germs, right? If I were to go back there again, I would take the time to drink the water, but I did not. Really quick, let's point out a couple of things that contextually we need to pay attention to, and then also tie into the video that we just saw. So contextually, right, this town is about 35, 40 miles due north of Jerusalem. And think about what the chapter as a whole is emphasizing as Jesus interacts with this woman. The primary point is that Jesus is the Messiah. And he's the Messiah of everyone. He's not just the Messiah for the Jews, he's the Messiah for the Samaritans and the Gentiles. He's the Messiah for everybody. And so the text emphasizes that as you go down through the chapter. And then I'm sure you've been in Bible classes as you go through John chapter 4, where the point is made that this is such a great and rich text to help us understand some principles about evangelism. Jesus is interacting with this woman, and as he interacts with her, she keeps trying to change the subject, and she jumps from one subject to another subject as she gets uncomfortable. And Jesus just lets the conversation go there. If she's going to jump, then he's going to jump with her. He follows her through her train of thought, but he keeps bringing her back around to truth as he goes. It's just such a great example. He doesn't allow his initial perception of this woman to get in the way. It doesn't matter to him that she's a Samaritan. It doesn't matter that he knows that she's disreputable. He sees someone with a soul that needs to understand who he is. Right? And then in the larger context of the Gospel of John, John is trying to emphasize and highlight the identity of Jesus. You know, he is the light. He is bread. He is life. He's living water. And so this fits into that larger context of the Gospel of John. Now, one of the things we tried to point out in the video is as you go down through the text and Jesus is asked, "Are you here to draw water? How are you going to accomplish that? Because the well is deep." Well, there's that little phrase within a sentence. But that matches up with what you saw. That particular well is 130 to 150 feet deep. And there's a good chunk of it where they're going through rock, solid rock. And people have asked, how do you know that that is most likely the location? Well, because the area around it is very arid. As you read through Genesis, you understand they kept track of water sources. They had fights over water sources. And so if you have a water source that is that pure, that clean, that cool, that is going to be able to be kept track of for so long, you hang on to that. And so for generations, they have kept track of this location. So the probability of it being Jacob's well is really, 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 really high. Now, what does all of this have to do with worship? Let's kind of read down through the text a little bit further, and we're not going to talk about everything in the chapter, but I want to get to the section where Jesus talks about worship. Let's pick up in verse 7. A woman from Samaria came to draw water. Jesus said to her, "Give me a drink." For his disciples had gone away into the city to buy food. The Samaritan woman said to him, "How is it that you, a Jew, ask for a drink from me, a woman of Samaria? For Jews have no dealings with Samaritans." Jesus answered her, "If you knew the gift of God and who it is that is saying to you, 'Give me a drink,' you would have asked him and he would have given you living water." The woman said to him, "Sir, you have nothing to draw with and the well is deep. Where do you get that living water? Are you greater than our father Jacob? He gave us the well and drank from it himself, as did his sons and his livestock." Jesus said to her, "Everyone who drinks of this water will be thirsty again. But whoever drinks of the water that I will give him will never be thirsty again. The water that I will give him will become in him a spring of water welling up to eternal life." The woman said to him, "Sir, give me this water so that I will not be thirsty or have to come here to draw water." And Jesus said to her, "Go, call your husband and come here." And the woman answered him, "I have no husband." And Jesus said to her, "You are right in saying, 'I have no husband,' for you have had five husbands, and the one you now have is not your husband. What you have said is true." The woman said to him, "Sir, I perceive that you are a prophet. Our fathers worshipped on this mountain, but you say that in Jerusalem is the place where people ought to worship." Jesus said to her, "Woman, believe me, the hour is coming when neither on this mountain nor in Jerusalem will you worship the Father. You worship what you do not know. We worship what we know, for salvation is from the Jews. But the hour is coming and is now here when true worshipers will worship the Father in spirit and truth. For the Father is seeking such people to worship him. God is spirit, and those who worship him must worship in spirit and truth." The woman said to him, "I know that Messiah is coming, he who is called Christ. When he comes, he will tell us all things." And Jesus said to her, "I who speak to you am he." And then as you keep reading, the disciples come back out and they marvel that he's interacting with this woman. And they question whether he's hungry, and he explains to them, "Look, I have food to eat that you don't understand." And he's talking about the work that he's doing. And then she goes and starts talking to people in town, "Can this be the Christ?" in verse 29. And they all come out, and Jesus continues to teach them and stays there for a little bit. Now let's back up. Let's back up and go to the section where he's talking about worship. And it follows that section where Jesus informs her that he knows things about her that she's never shared. He says, "Go and call your husband." She says, "Oh, I'm not married." He's like, "I know you're not married. You've actually been married five times and you're living with someone that you're not married to now." And she doesn't address that. She doesn't get super defensive. She just changes gears and says, "Well, you must be a prophet." And then she gets into something that she's hoping will kind of distract from what Jesus just said. I mean, what are the two topics that you're not supposed to talk about? Religion and taxes? Maybe politics you throw in there. Just really awkward conversations with strangers. And so she jumps to this crucial difference between Jews and Samaritans. And one of the critical differences between the two of them is, where should God's people worship? The Jews, according to her perspective, the Jews say you worship at Mount Zion in Jerusalem, right? And what she is saying is that God's people, the Samaritans, worship on Mount Gerizim, just a couple of miles away. And so she brings up a controversial religious issue. And Jesus addresses that in verse 21. He said to her, "Woman, believe me, the hour is coming when neither on this mountain nor in Jerusalem will you worship the Father. You worship what you do not know. We worship what we know, for salvation is from the Jews. But the hour is coming and is now here when true worshipers will worship the Father in spirit and truth. For the Father is seeking such people to worship Him." Let's break this down and make four or five points about worship. Okay, and one might just seem super, super obvious, but it's okay to be Captain Obvious sometimes, because we miss this point. The first point is this. The object of our worship, if it's going to be pleasing, the object of our worship is God. And both Jesus and the Samaritan woman agree with that point. They have agreement on that point. They're talking about and disagreeing about the location of that worship, but their initial acknowledgement is there is a God. He's Jehovah, the God of the people of Israel, and He is who we should be worshiping. Now, there are people that we interact with on a daily basis that don't even agree with that point. But we need to start with true worship, if it's going to be biblical, is going to be a worship of God. And there are so many places that we could talk about that emphasize that, but let's just look at a couple. The first is over in Exodus chapter 20. In verses 1 through 7, as you read through the Ten Commandments, or the ten words, this is what you're going to hear. God spoke all of these words, saying, "I am the Lord your God, who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of slavery. You shall have no other gods before me." You don't worship, you don't bow down to, you don't acknowledge that, you don't worship anyone or anything except me. It's an exclusive relationship. And he goes on to elaborate, "You shall not make for yourselves a carved image or any likeness of anything that is in heaven above or that is in the earth beneath or that is in the water under the earth. You shall not bow down to them or serve them, for I, the Lord, your God, am a jealous God, visiting the iniquity of the fathers on the children to the third and fourth generation of those who hate me, but showing steadfast love to thousands of those who love me and keep my commandments." And there's something I want to touch on just for a second. It was something that I had to wrestle through as I thought about God and His nature and who He was and what He was like. It is important in verse 5 to understand the jealousy of God. Because multiple times in the Old Testament, God establishes this truth, "I'm a jealous God." And I remember the day that I learned what the definition for jealousy was. I remember. It was actually after a Sunday morning worship. My family had gone out to the car, and I was probably 5, maybe 6, and we had gotten into the van, and my Bible class teacher that I had a crush on as a 5 and a 6-year-old was walking past, and she had just gotten engaged, and my dad teased me because I was jealous. I was like, "What? I don't even know what you're talking about. What is jealousy?" So at 5 or 6, I'm trying to figure out what jealousy is. And then with a simple understanding of jealousy, you start encountering these phrases about the jealousy of God, but there's something we need to understand about the jealousy of God. There is a difference between being jealous of someone and jealous for someone. Jealous of someone and jealous for someone. When I'm jealous of someone, I want something that that person has that I don't. I'm jealous of them because they possess something that I want to possess. I'm jealous of them. But when I'm jealous for someone, what I'm saying is I want the person. As God is going through the Ten Commandments and explaining the exclusive nature of His relationship with His people, He's describing a similar type of relationship that a husband and a wife ought to have for each other. It's exclusive. And I'm jealous for you, and you should be jealous for me, and nothing and no one is going to come in between us. It's exclusive. And if my relationship with God is what it ought to be, then He is the only one that I will worship. And if I happen to break that exclusivity, God has every right to be upset because he's jealous for me. He wants me. So the object of our worship is God. Think about another example, another biblical example. You remember Elijah and the prophets of Baal at Mount Carmel, 1 Kings chapter 18, where Israel is wrestling with worshiping Baal and idolatry, and Elijah is trying to bring people back around to worshiping God, and there's this contest where he allows the 400 prophets of Baal to start the day off with sacrificing. There's this competition that they have. And there is a beautiful, beautiful, convicting statement made in 1 Kings 18:21. What you have in 1 Kings 18:21 is you have Elijah stand before the people of God and say this. He came near all the people and said, "How long will you go limping between two different ideas, two different opinions? If the Lord is God, follow him. But if Baal, then follow him." And to their shame, the people did not answer him a word. It can't be both. You can't worship God and Baal. You can't follow God and Baal. It's an exclusive worship. And God demonstrated in 1 Kings chapter 18. He demonstrated that God was the one we ought to be worshiping. Let's look at another passage. Matthew chapter 4. Matthew chapter 4, verses 8 through 11. You have Jesus as he's tempted in the wilderness. And Satan tries to get him to bow down and to worship him. And if he does that, he'll give him all the kingdoms of the earth, which is such an empty thing to offer the Son of God. And what Jesus does is he quotes Exodus, he quotes the Ten Commandments, and says, "I'm not going to worship anyone or anything except God. I'm not going to worship anyone or anything except God." There's an important point to make here, and we could have a lesson just on this. So I'm going to try to say it quickly. And maybe if you have questions about this at the end of the lesson, we can review it a little bit. Okay? The struggle with worshiping God exclusively is this. Our hearts are actively worshiping all the time. Our hearts are actively worshiping someone or something all the time. Not just when we're worshiping collectively, but so many of the decisions that I make in life have to do with who or what I'm worshiping. Who or what I'm putting first in my life. And the temptation throughout the course of my life is to replace God with someone or something else, which is idolatry. An idol doesn't have to just be an image sitting on a shelf or sitting in a courtyard or sitting in a niche in your house. So we need to guard against that and understand that the worship of God is something that we do all of the time. Our hearts are actively worshiping all of the time. The second thing that we want to talk about is worship. Worship is a response. Worship is a response. And I'll illustrate what I mean by that. Think back to Genesis. And think back to Noah and his family. Genesis chapter 6. And you think about the global flood that God sent, and he delivered Noah and his wife, the sons and daughters-in-law. He saved those 8 people through the ark. Right? They're on that boat. The entire known world at that time has changed so much death. What is the first thing that Noah did when he stepped foot on solid ground in Genesis chapter 8? He built an altar and he worshiped. The very first thing that he did after being delivered, in response to being delivered, was to praise God. To worship God. Another incredible example. Think about Exodus. The people of God have gone through 4 centuries of slavery and bondage, hard labor, burdens. They've been crying out to God. God has heard their cry. He uses Moses to lead them out of Egypt. And as they escape the army of Pharaoh and they cross the Red Sea, Exodus chapter 14. When you get to Exodus 15, after the Red Sea has swallowed up Pharaoh's army, what do they do on the other side of the sea? They sing. They sing. The whole congregation sings. Why? Because they've just been delivered from slavery and death. Their song was a song of praise and response. How about this? This one should be super convicting to God's people. Think about Jonah. Just for a second. Think about Jonah chapter 1. You think about the job that God gave Jonah. I want you to go to the Ninevites. I want you to warn them. And Jonah says, nope, not going to go. Runs away. Gets on the boat. They're sailing away from where he's supposed to be going. God throws a storm down on the sea. And the pagan sailors, the heathen sailors, are trying to figure out what is going on. They attribute that storm to supernatural activity. And so the captain of the ship is telling everyone to pray to their respective gods, but it's not having any kind of effect. And he goes down to Jonah and says, hey, who are you? What are you doing? What's going on? And Jonah tells him, well, I worship the God that created everything, the earth and the sea, and I've disobeyed him. And they are terrified. They try to save his life. Eventually, Jonah says, you have to throw me overboard. And eventually, those conscience-stricken pagans who don't want to throw Jonah overboard eventually do. And as soon as he hits the water, the storm stops. And do you know what those pagans do? Those pagans pray. Because they'd just been delivered from a storm. Those pagan sailors had more respect for God in Jonah chapter 1 than Jonah had, the prophet. Which is one of the convicting things about the book of Jonah. There are things about Jonah and his responses with God that weren't the greatest, but the heathens around him were responding really well. Worship is a response. And there's something about this that I want us to talk about, some nuance. I hope it's not as much of an issue as it was maybe 10, 12 years ago. But I remember a conversation 10 or 12 years ago about trying to figure out, is the best, most sincere worship always a personal, spontaneous response? Or is the best, most pleasing worship congregational, planned response? That was an interesting discussion, and I think it went some ways it didn't need to go, but this is what I would say. As you look at what the Bible says, worship can be both a personal response. James chapter 5:13, if anyone among you, let him sing, let him pray, let him... But it's also a collective response. And you look at the epistles, and as the apostles are writing to churches, they're telling them how to worship. And to have orderly worship and decent worship. No more than so many people prophesying at any given assembly. So it's not an either-or proposition. It's not only personal responses and only collective responses. It's both. In the life of a Christian, I need to have collective congregational worship that I participate in. And I should be worshiping God individually as well. And as far as spontaneity or scheduled, it's both. Some of these examples, they're spontaneous moments of worship, especially with the heathens on the ship or the Israelites after crossing the Red Sea. That wasn't scheduled. It was just a spontaneous moment of worship to God. Do you know even Paul in his epistles does that? As you read through the epistles, there are times where Paul is writing, and in the middle of writing, he will burst out in a prayer of praise and then jump back to his point. Because he's so overwhelmed with the truth that he's saying about God. But there are times where it's meant to be scheduled. So again, it's not an either or. It's a both and. But worship is a response to what God has both said and done. Worship is a response to what God has said and done. It's a response to divine revelation. Let's look at John chapter 4 again for our third point. John chapter 4, look at verse 20 and 21. Our fathers, Jesus said, the woman said, our fathers worshipped on this mountain, but you say that in Jerusalem is the place where people ought to worship. And Jesus said to her, woman, believe me, the hour is coming when neither on this mountain nor in Jerusalem will you worship the Father. Jesus does something really interesting here. For a second, he doesn't address whether the Jews have it right and the Samaritans have it wrong. For a minute, he just forgets all of that. What he's saying is that a time was coming where it wasn't going to matter. A time was coming where the whole discussion about Mount Zion versus Mount Gerizim wasn't going to matter. And as you look at the verse, you have to start asking yourself the question, so when is that time? And what's going to make that change? Do you know what's going to make that change? Jesus is going to make that change. The location of pleasing worship to God was about to be changed by Jesus and his death, burial, and resurrection. That was about to be changed. The hour was near. We're going to have more to say about that in just a minute. But then he does come back to the discussion that she brought up, the question that she brought up, in verse 22. He doesn't ignore it. And we need to take a lesson here, a note here. He's about to point out that she's mistaken. But he's not going to be arrogant. He's not going to be demeaning. He's not going to be insulting. He's not going to call her names. He doesn't ramp up his tone. He doesn't call up his friends. He doesn't get on social media. He has a calm and compassionate, reasoned conversation with her and gently says something that she needs to hear. In verse 22, he says, "You worship what you do not know. We worship what we know. For salvation is from the Jews." Do you understand what he's saying? He's saying that worship is based on divine revelation, and the worship of the Samaritans was not based on that. You don't know what you're doing. Your worship is not based on the knowledge that comes from God. We worship at right now based on the knowledge we have received from God. Your worship is uninformed by God. Our worship is informed by God. There is a big difference between the two. Let's talk about that for just a second as I show you a picture. Because in 2017, there are still Samaritans going up to the top of Mount Gerizim to worship. 2,000 years later, after Jesus said to the Samaritan woman, "Your worship is not based on knowledge. You don't know what you're doing." Let's talk about that for just a second. When you go back in the Old Testament and you look at God's history with Israel, in Deuteronomy, multiple times, especially in chapter 12, Moses emphasized to the Israelites that when God finally led them into the land of Israel, the land of Canaan, that God would choose a place. God would choose a place to cause His name to dwell there. And in every verse, the emphasis is on God's choice. God was going to choose. And so you have all of these verses, Deuteronomy 12, 5, 11, 14, 18, 20, 26. God will choose. God will choose. God will choose. The emphasis is God gets to choose. It's not up to the Israelites to choose. And then in 2 Chronicles chapter 6, in the first 11 verses, you have the chronicler giving you Solomon's prayer of dedication over the temple that was built in Jerusalem. And what Solomon acknowledges is, "God, you have chosen Mount Zion. You have chosen Mount Zion as the place where we will worship you." So in Deuteronomy, Moses said, God's going to pick a place. Solomon in 2 Chronicles said, God picked a place. And the place was Jerusalem. The place was Mount Zion. The place was where the temple was built. Then you have the Samaritans come into existence. 2 Kings 17, you have the 70 years of captivity. You have intermarriage going on between the Israelites that are left in the land. The Samaritan people come up into being. And then they have to choose, where are we going to worship? And what they choose is they choose Mount Gerizim, a few miles away, a few miles north of Jerusalem. And that's not accidental. I want to emphasize a little bit about the history of Mount Gerizim. Do you remember in Deuteronomy, one of the things that Moses said to do was when the Israelites came into the land of Canaan, they were supposed to go to two mountains and gather the people on either side of this valley, and they were supposed to read the terms of the covenant. And as they read the blessings of the covenant, one side would cheer that, and as they would pronounce the curses of disobedience, the other side would acknowledge that. So imagine, like, a huge, huge stadium, football stadium, massive, and they're chanting back and forth these blessings and these cursings to each other. Mount Gerizim was one of them. That's mentioned over in Deuteronomy 11 and chapter 27. And then in Joshua chapter 8, Joshua leads the people to that valley, to Mount Ebal and Mount Gerizim, and he leads them through it. And so they chose, the Samaritans chose, a significant mountain to the Israelites. It was significant to their history. It had to do with their relationship with God. It's the first place in the land of Canaan where they remembered their covenant. And so you think about the difference between the Jews and the Samaritans. They had similar starting points. They're both going back to Deuteronomy. Right? They both had mountains with historical significance to the people of Israel. Very similar. Both the Jews and the Samaritans observed the Passover, but at their respective mountains. Geographically, the mountains are so close to each other. Relatively speaking, they're so close. But do you realize what Jesus is saying when he says you worship what you don't know? Getting it close and being enthusiastic does not cover neglecting what God has said. It doesn't matter how enthusiastic you are about what you're doing. If you don't respond to what God has said, it's not based on knowledge. It's not pleasing to God. Can I give you just a couple of examples? What about Genesis chapter 4? And the offering of Cain and Abel. I'm sure both boys were pretty enthusiastic about offering to God, but God wasn't pleased with one of them. What about Nadab and Abihu over in Leviticus chapter 10? And let's turn there. I know I've referenced several passages, but I want us to look at this one because this one just really hit me in my early 30s. Leviticus chapter 10. I mean, I grew up hearing about the warning of the strange fire offered by Nadab and Abihu. Right? The strange fire, the fire that God did not authorize. They violated what God said, and so God killed them. He did. I mean, on the surface, that's all factually correct, but I think it misses a bigger point. Again, like we've mentioned every night this week so far, it ignores a larger context. I think there's a stronger point to be made. Let's look at verse 1 of Leviticus 10. Now Nadab and Abihu, the sons of Aaron, each took his censer and put fire in it and laid incense on it, offered unauthorized or strange fire before the Lord, which he had not commanded them. And fire came out from before the Lord and consumed them, and they died before the Lord. And Moses said to Aaron, "This is what the Lord has said. Among those who are near me, I will be sanctified, and before all the people, I will be glorified." And Aaron held his peace. And we go to that passage to talk about Bible authority. That's right. But we're still missing a bigger point. You need to back up into chapter 9. And maybe start looking at the motive or what was going through those boys' minds when they did that. Let's put it in context. Leviticus, God is setting up the people of Levi to serve as his priests. He's setting up the whole Levitical system. He's explaining all of the different sacrifices, all of the different offerings, all of the different festival days. He's explaining all of that. He is helping a nation develop their law. When a group starts something new, how much enthusiasm is there? Like a lot? As people come together, I've been blessed to be a part of groups that were building a new place of worship, a new church building. And the enthusiasm and excitement that's there when they start that. Or a new evangelist comes to town, hopefully there's some enthusiasm and excitement about that. Just the newness of things. This, the people of Israel, they went into Egypt, 70 people of a family, and came out a nation, millions strong. They came out a nation. And God gave them a law, and He was setting up their worship, and He was taking them to their new home. And in all of that, in chapter 9, He is setting aside Aaron and his sons to finally serve as priests for the first time. They're being sanctified and set apart. They're being given their brand new priestly robes. Do you think those boys might be on a little bit of an emotional high? The answer is yes. You look at verse 22 of Leviticus 9. Aaron lifted up his hands toward the people and blessed them. He came down from offering the sin offering and the burnt offering and the peace offering. Moses and Aaron went into the tent of meeting, and when they came out, they blessed the people, and the glory of the Lord appeared to all the people. God showed up in some way. Fire came out in verse 24 from before the Lord and consumed the burnt offering and the pieces of fat on the altar. And when all the people saw it, they shouted and fell on their faces. You think they might be excited? So this is the bigger point. And it goes into the point we've been making. I don't think the boys were sloppy. I don't think they were lazy. I don't think they were intentionally like, we're going to change God's commands the first time around. Like, I just don't think that was what happened. I think they were enthusiastic. I think they were excited. I think they sincerely thought that God would be pleased with this. They were wrong. And God made an example out of them. And someone shared this quote, and I think it summarizes the point. No matter how ceremonially elaborate, no matter how emotionally rousing, no matter how sermonically eloquent, worship that is not offered from a proper understanding of who God is falls short. Isn't that a great statement? This is what this is saying. It doesn't matter how pretty it looks. It doesn't matter how worked up you get. It doesn't matter how good I talk. If worship doesn't match up with what God has said, it's not acceptable. Now, that's not to say we should be emotionless in our worship. I think that's like falling off the other side. It's appropriate to feel deeply what God has done for us and express that in appropriate ways. But we need to make sure it matches up with what God has said. Think about that. Think about our current worship. What do we do when we congregationally assemble? What has God called us to do? What do we see His churches in the New Testament doing? We see them assembling on the first day of the week. We see them partaking of the Lord's Supper together. The text emphasizes, especially in 1 Corinthians chapter 11, the necessity of assembling when you assemble, when you assemble, when you assemble. The text actually rebuked the church in Corinth for their lack of reverence for God when they assembled. And the text, that text we'll talk about more about this tomorrow. The text in 1 Corinthians 11 addresses both the communal and the individual aspect of the Lord's Supper. Right? Or you think about singing. I need to engage my heart as I sing. Ephesians 5:19, Colossians 3:15. We want to make sure that our worship matches up with what God has said, what God has authorized, so that it will be pleasing to Him. John 4:23, going back to John chapter 4, where Jesus says, "The hour is coming and is now here when true worshipers will worship the Father in spirit and in truth, for the Father is seeking such people to worship Him." Worship requires active participation. It's not a spectator sport. It's something that I am supposed to engage myself in wholly. And I want to ask you, just for a second, let's use a little bit of logic and common sense. Is Jesus saying here that this is a change? That all of the worship that was offered to God before this moment did not require worshiping Him in spirit and truth? The answer is no. The worship of God has always required people to worship in spirit and in truth. Always. But Jesus repeats that phrase that he's already used. The hour is coming. Something is about to shift it. And what is it that's going to shift it? What's about to be different? And then if you look at the context, what's about to be different is Jesus. Jesus, the Messiah, the Son of God, is about to make it different. The worship of God was going to change from what he had prescribed to the Israelites to what he instructed the citizens of his kingdom after his resurrection. What he authorized through inspiration to the apostles. Where Jesus, the Son of God, was going to speak and reveal. You think about what the Hebrew writer said about Jesus. Hebrews 1, 1 through 3. Long ago, at many times and in many ways, God spoke to our fathers by the prophets. But in these last days, he has spoken to us by his Son, whom he appointed the heir of all things, through whom he also created the world. He is the radiance of the glory of God and the exact imprint of his nature. He upholds the universe by the word of his power. Let's make a comparison. If the Israelites in Exodus chapter 14, as they were delivered from Pharaoh's army, if those people, under the law of Moses, Leviticus, which was just about to be given to them, if those people had a reason to worship God in spirit and in truth, then don't you think those of us who live on this side of the cross have even more? That's what Jesus is trying to emphasize. He is the one that is about to change that. He's the one who's about to ramp it up. He's the one who's going to be the fulfillment of all of those foreshadowing things. Someone said it this way, and I really, really appreciate it. In spirit and truth can only mean rendering such homage to God that the entire heart enters into the act, and doing this in full harmony with the truth of God as revealed in his word. All of me. I'm offering God all of me. Whether it's private worship or public worship, whether it's spontaneous or scheduled, my worship of God is supposed to involve all of me. I love that idea. I don't know how many of you are familiar with Sister Glenda Shales and some of the hymns that she has written over the years. But she wrote a song that I just think encapsulates this thought so well. Are you familiar with "I Have a Passion for My God"? I have a passion for my God. I have a passion for my God. He is first in my heart. He is first in my life. He is first in all I do. The essence of all good, the source of all that's true. I have a passion for my God. I have a passion for my God. He's the all of my heart. He's the all of my life. He's the all that I pursue. My God, my every breath and thought must be for you. That is the attitude of worship. Where it has engaged the worshiper wholly. The object is God. It's in response to him and what he has said and what he has done. They're active and they're participating. It's based on knowledge. It's based on knowledge. What are you worshiping? Because you're worshiping someone or something. Every minute of every day, you are worshiping someone or something. And for those of us who are followers of Jesus, the Son of God, ultimately, we worship God. We worship the Son. Is that who you're worshiping right now? If you're not, what you're worshiping is so empty. And it's temporary. And it's not going to fulfill, it's not going to satisfy, and it's going to leave you really disappointed come the day of judgment. If you recognize that, then I hope, like the Samaritan woman, you would come to recognize that there is something about Jesus that you need to acknowledge. He's the Messiah, and he's who you've been waiting for. And it's by his sacrifice that your sins can be atoned. And it's by being baptized into him that your sins can be forgiven. If there's someone that needs to become a Christian and choose to start worshiping Jesus, worshiping God, we would ask you to make that decision tonight. And if there's a Christian here that has realized you've put something else ahead of him, you've put something else ahead of God, maybe it's a possession. Maybe it's a degree. Maybe it's a person. No one can take the place of God in your life. No one else can be God but God. Let's repent of that and put God first again. If there's someone that needs to start worshiping God in spirit and truth, please come to the front and let us know while we stand and while we sing.
Do you know that song well enough to teach us? It's in our... Do you?
I do.
Okay. Can we do that later?
Yep.
Good. Get out your supplement and turn to number 68. I noticed that song, and Jeremy's going to... We'll pay you extra this weekend to teach us a song. Jeremy is going to teach us that song. I'm not familiar with that, so I'm anxious to learn that. 68 in our supplement. Appreciate that fine lesson on worship, a great reminder. And we have an opportunity now if you have any questions or comments. We want to know if the water tasted good. So
that's right. I've got to go back to Annapolis. So in just a second, we'll practice 68. Before that, are there any questions that y'all have? Y'all are ready to practice 68. Either that or the preacher preached way long.
Give Carlin just a minute. He's going to look
at. Great. So for those who are who want to ask a question, now's your chance.
Question.
Yes, sir.
I assume that the individual worship and the worship that we do with obviously with a group is all always be in truth.
Yes.
I know that sometimes, you know, when growing up, for example, my family who members of the church would play hymns, and they said, we're not in worship, so they, you know, I'm not trying to throw my family under the bus or anything, but
yeah,
they would, you know, play with a guitar, and they think, well, it's okay, they're not in worship, and I always felt uncomfortable with that.
Yeah.
And so anyway, just talk about that if you don't mind.
Yeah, well, and thinking about your life of worship, I think it's helpful to think about that concept. Your life is meant to be a life of worship. So the decisions that you make, the way that you interact with people, is a reflection of who you worship and what you live for. So the way that you interact as a husband and wife is a part of your day of worship. The Hebrew writer, toward the end of Hebrews, I believe it's in chapter 13, talks about the worship of our lips. So the things that we say, how we say them, all of that has to do with our worship to God. And so I think when I was younger, there was, in my own mind, there was an overemphasis on congregational worship, and I didn't appreciate enough that I had a daily life of worship. But I think, especially about 15 years ago, some of the folks that were writing articles and books focused so much on that, they de-emphasized the importance and necessity of congregational worship, corporate worship. And so that's why I tried to point out there's a both and. You're not supposed to elevate one to the diminishment of the other. In the Christian life, God expects corporate and personal worship. And you see that dynamic even in 1 Corinthians chapter 11, like I mentioned. We'll talk about that tomorrow. That might help with some of that. Anybody else? I hope I didn't muddy that water too much or leave a big old can of worms for Chris. Go ahead, Chris.
I was going to just make this point that back in the 90s, yeah, it was real popular to talk about all life is worship.
Right.
And brethren, some were trying to make the point that everything you do in life is worship. When you're washing dishes, that is worship. And when you're changing a baby's diaper, that's worship. And we've got to be careful about that, because I don't know of anywhere in the scripture that says every little act you do is worship. There are things that are prescribed that make it worship. Now, some of those things don't have to be corporate.
Correct.
They don't have to be, but they are certain things that are worship. Abraham said to Isaac in Genesis 2, let us go over here and worship.
Yeah.
Well, if all life is worship, they would have been doing that before they got there, but they were going to go somewhere and worship,
yeah,
because a sacrifice was prescribed, And so I would be careful about saying all life is worship, because what some wanted to do with that, it did tend toward wanting to do instrumental music and some other things, and you've got to be really careful about that. There are things that we can do at home by ourselves to worship, but they're still prescribed things, and washing dishes is not one of those, or folding clothes, or, you know. So it's a balancing act between saying that we can do some things at home, but not just making everything.
Yeah, so inconsistence, being consistent with what God has revealed.
Right.
Whether you're at home or with your congregation, you want to make sure that you're doing things consistently with what God has revealed. And I think Chris used an important word, the idea of offering or sacrifice. You know, I'm not only making an offering to God when I'm here singing in a group. There are things that I offer to God or I sacrifice to God on an individual, personal level. And so there are some things where you acknowledge that there are some things that a congregation can and should do, and things that they should not do because they're not an individual, and the other way around. So there's a lot of nuance to all of that. So there's caution, but understanding that there's more to it than maybe what we've heard. And we can keep talking about that too. Like I said, can of worms for Chris. I'm sorry.